Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. We are going through the 12 or 13 days of Christmas, if you like. And today, of course, is the 30th of December. And Dominic, we have two new anniversaries.
I have chosen
the Battle of Wakefield.
So this is a good one. I like the Battle of Wakefield.
Why do you like the Battle of Wakefield? Do you want to tell people when it is?
Yeah, it's a Wars of the Roses battle, isn't it? It's the...
Do you know the date?
It's the 30th of December, 1460.
Very good. Yeah, very good.
Well, I knew it was the 30th of December.
Yeah, of course.
So it's Richard of York's last hurrah, isn't it? Not much of a hurrah.
Richard of York gave battle in vain, which is the way you remember the colours of the rainbow.
Oh, yes. Very good.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. So I used to love the Wars of the Roses when I was a child, when I was about 11.
Do you not any longer?
I do, but I've sort of, I suppose I...
You've grown out of it.
I wouldn't say I've grown out of it.
You've moved on to Jim Callaghan.
The trouble is that now I think of the Wars of the Roses, I struggle to see what it means beyond the kind of dynastic
feuding. Just people
killing
each other.
Yeah. See, I think it's pure Game of Thrones, sort of families feuding for the crown, but without any... There's no religious dimension. There's no... I find it hard to see any deeper kind of political significance other than, you know, cousin A wants to get kill cousin B and get the throne.
Well, I mean, there's a further complication that is how Shakespeare frames it. And Shakespeare's plays, Henry VI, part one, part two, part three, a crucial part, you know, I mean, crucially influence that sense of it. And then, of course, Richard III.
But it's Shakespeare who creates the idea of the roses, isn't it? They pluck roses in a garden in Henry VI, part one.
I think that's, is it Holinshed? It's one of the chroniclers, I think.
Yeah.
So that's, it's not contemporary. But Shakespeare's reworking of it is obviously, been very influential. And you're right. I mean, it is basically dynastic politics, but it's also blowback from the defeat of France.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the Hundred Years' War. Noblemen who've, you know, been doing well in France, who suddenly lost all their territory and have to come back and throw their weight around in England. There are lots of men at arms who, you know, seasoned fighters who are looking for basically a job. And so it's a kind of, you know, it's just waiting to explode.
But it's also, there's been a complete breakdown of central authority, hasn't there? Because Henry VI is too godly. All he cares about is praying and thinking about educational establishments.
He has a complete mental breakdown. So 1453, absolute mental breakdown. And so the kingdom needs a regent. It needs a Lord Protector.
Yeah.
And a further complication to this, and this is certainly something that for Shakespeare is very important, I think possibly less so actually in the 15th century, is the fact that the House of Lancaster, of which Henry is the third king, so the previous ones, Henry V and Henry IV, are usurpers.
That probably wouldn't be so much of an issue, Tom, if he'd been sane. Right? I mean,
no,
people
absolutely.
Just got on with it.
Absolutely. But Henry IV had deposed Richard II and seized the throne. But there are various other descendants of Edward III, and there's an awful lot of kings in this episode, I mean, perforce, floating around. And one of them is Richard of York. So the family of York, they also can lay claim to a descent from Edward III, just as Henry VI can. And so the question starts to bubble up, well, if Henry's can be king, why can't I?
Yeah. And if Henry's mad, then why shouldn't we have Richard as our king when he's a able administrator and a proven soldier and all these kinds of things?
Yeah. So when Henry VI has his breakdown, Richard is appointed Lord Protector. And this is kind of interesting, I'd be interested to kind of check the exact monthly cycles around this. During Henry's breakdown, Margaret of Anjou has a son. So until that point, Henry hadn't had an heir, and it's a son. So it looks as though the line of descent for the House of Lancaster is secure.
Yeah,
which is bad news for Richard of York. You know, if he wants to become king. So after 18 months, Henry VI recovers his sanity. York is basically cross about this. And there are various other noblemen, chief among them the Nevilles. So that's the Earl of Salisbury and his son, the Earl of Warwick, who will become famous as Warwick the Kingmaker, subject of a Ladybird book, no less.
I loved that book.
So that's the real measure of his...
That to me was the acme of the Ladybird books, because it was just pure, nothing but fighting.
Yeah. Loads of people in armour, kind of wrestling in autumn, mud and things. So there's a big battle at St. Albans. Henry VI is taken prisoner, and York gets himself reappointed as Lord Protector.
I like that battle, Tom, because it's an unusual medieval battle, because it happens in the city, doesn't it?
It does,
in the town.
Yes. Yeah.
They're running through the streets fighting, yeah. Which you don't normally have in a medieval
hill.
Battle.
Up the
Very
hill.
Exciting.
Up from the river.
Make a great HBO series, I think, The Wars of the Roses.
Well, I think it already has done, hasn't it?
Well, with dragons in though.
So that's an attempt to draw up a kind of truce. But it falls to pieces because obviously Margaret of Anjou, people backing the Lancastrians, the enemies of Richard the York, enemy of Warwick, not happy with that. And 1459, the war breaks out again. And it catches York and the Nevilles slightly by surprise. They flee to Ludlow. You must know well.
I know very well. Very good castle, Ludlow Castle.
Well, so they hang out in the castle. They get cornered there.
Yeah.
There's a battle. They all flee in all directions. So York flees to Ireland. The Nevilles and Richard of York's son, Edward.
Yeah.
Big, strapping young lad.
Yeah.
Future Edward IV.
He's sort of young Elvis, isn't he? And he later will become Fat Elvis in Las Vegas.
Yeah. They flee to Calais. And the Yorkists are declared traitors. But they're still on the loose. 1460, Edward, the future Edward IV, and Warwick land from Calais.
Yeah.
They attack the Lancastrians at Northampton. Once again, they capture Henry VI. He's absolutely useless. I mean, all he does is kind of wander around getting captured, saying prayers and things. And Duke of York rushes back, goes to London. He enters London and he lays claim to the throne. He says, I should be king. And this goes down tremendously badly. Even with his allies, they think this is a, you know, you can't just go around opposing kings like this.
Yeah, that's strange, isn't it? That's a reminder of one of your favourite themes, which is the sacral nature of kingship.
It is.
That they don't want to, they really believe in those kind of coronation oaths and all that.
Not
anointing
all the waters in the rough rude sea can wash the balm off an anointed king.
Is that Shakespeare?
It's Richard II
right.
saying that, which of course... You know, it actually turns out that they can.
But he was quite wrong.
So that's the kind of... But in this case, Richard is toppled because he's a nightmare. People stay loyal to Henry because he's inoffensive.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
He's completely out of his depth. But he's out of his depth.
Yeah, he's treason.
So they kind of draw up a compromise, which is that Henry will stay king, but Edward, the Prince of Wales, so the son that Margaret of Anjou had when he'd been mad, would be dispossessed. And Edward, Richard of York's son, and a lot of Edwards and Richards and things. Are very
I hope
confusing.
People are keeping up with the words, Tom.
There'll be a test. He'll become the heir. So basically, Richard of York and his sons will be the heirs. So that's going to be the Yorkists and the new line of succession. And Margaret of Anjou, obviously, is livid, absolutely livid. About this, all the Lancastrians, and they go on the attack in the north, which of course is where York's heartlands are. So they kind of zoom in on all his lands in around York. And the whole point of being a feudal lord is that you protect your lands, your bannermen. So York goes rushing up to take on this threat, and he takes his son, Edmund, the second son, the Earl of Rutland, with him. And they get bottled up in a castle called Sandal outside Wakefield.
Yeah.
And they're outnumbered. They know that reinforcements are coming. But for some reason, Richard launches a sally out from York.
No one knows why this happens, do they? It's a complete shambles, isn't it? Because it's not... The Battle of Wakefield is not really like a pitched battle, isn't it? It's like a sort of punch-up in a wood or something.
He kind of staggers out into a... Yeah, he kind of gets mugged.
Yeah.
And various theories as to what might have happened. You know, did he not realise what was happening? Was he told that people were coming? Was it braggadocio? Was he furious at being taunted by Margaret? Don't know. But anyway, he and Edmund are both killed. The Earl of Rutland, and they get decapitated, and their heads get put over the gates of York, and the head of Richard has a paper crown put on it. And he becomes the object of great mockery. And in Shakespeare's play, this is famously a scene of great pathos. And there's Richard confronts Margaret of Anjou with the famous line, "O tiger's heart wrapped in a woman's hide." which is one of Shakespeare's most famous lines among his contemporaries. And people kind of, you know, they parody it and quote it and over again, which is a kind of measure of the impact that the play had and his portrayal of this dramatic scene. And I think it's the idea of, you know, this famous warrior being humbled at the feet of a French woman.
But the interesting thing with Shakespeare, though, is that Shakespeare's quite ambivalent, isn't he? Because ultimately, his sympathies are with the Lancastrians, aren't they? Because in Richard III, obviously, the final Yorkist is a tremendous villain. And Henry VII, Henry Tudor, is going to come along. And obviously, Shakespeare wants to celebrate the Tudors for obvious reasons. Yeah. They're the sort of status quo.
So Margaret, Richard, women are soft, mild, pitiful, and flexible. Thou stern, obdurate, flinty, rough, remorseless. and Margaret, ahistorically in Shakespeare, she survives into the reign of Richard III. And she's this kind of chorus stroke fury that kind of glides onto the action of the play with her luck operations. Moaning and
but she's a tremendous character anyway, Shakespeare or no Shakespeare. She's one of medieval history's great kind of impressive women, isn't she? She's basically lumbered with this dead loss of a husband.
And she does fight like a tiger for her son.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's so paper crown on head, that's no way to go, but it's a good story.
Richard of York gave battle in vain.
We shall return after the break with another slightly useless ruler, actually, but we should be heading into the 20th
but a
century.
Saintly ruler, right? I mean, literally.
Yeah, very saintly ruler. Well, we shall discuss this.
Okay, so we'll see you back.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. Tom has given us the Battle of Wakefield and the end of Richard, Duke of York. I am going to give us the coronation of the last Habsburg emperor, Karl I, or Charles I, on the 30th of December, 1916. In Buda, by Budapest. So we're in the First World War, and Austria, or Austria-Hungary, has basically, for long as anyone can remember, been in the sort of shadow of this extraordinary figure, the Emperor Franz Joseph, who is this...
Mutton chops.
This mutton chop whiskered, absolute symbol of army discipline, of sobriety, of austerity, of service. He's sort of in some ways, he's the sort of 19th century equivalent of Elizabeth II. So everybody he never says anything.
That's
interesting.
That's a great comparison. I'd never thought of that. Yeah.
He's just by sheer longevity, he has sort of worked his way into the affections of his people. He absolutely incarnates kind of conservatism, service, patriotism, all these kinds of things. But by now he's about 140. The First World War has broken out in 1914. The Austro-Hungarians have started, of course, by declaring war on Serbia to punish them for the assassination of Franz Ferdinand.
Now, France hasn't necessarily developed to their advantage.
It has not developed to their advantage at all. So they've been humiliated in Serbia. They've just, in 1916, been on the receiving end of the Brusilov offensive by the Russians, this colossal offensive that has killed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Austro-Hungarians and almost swept the empire away. So they've been generally very, you know, it hasn't gone well. I should say in German, it's Franz Josef. He has had an incredibly unlucky time with his family. So his wife, Sisi, Elizabeth, who's this very romantic sort of Diana figure of the 19th century.
Who, Dominic, if you had not been felled by COVID.
Yeah.
And you'd come to the Corfu Literary Festival, you would have heard all about her, because we did. I did it with Michael Taylor, who stepped in to your shoes.
Yeah.
Very, very admirably.
Yeah.
We did an event at the house, the extraordinary house on Corfu that was built for her.
Oh my word. And I missed out on this.
You did miss out
on it. So in the reporting generally of the pandemic, I think my suffering has not been sufficiently, been given
a chance
attention.
Now for you to,
yeah,
to let
milk it.
Know.
Well, anyway, she was stabbed by an Italian anarchist. So she was murdered. His son, Rudolf, Franz Josef's son, Rudolf, it's an extraordinary incident at the hunting lodge at Meierling, kills himself in a sort of strange murder-suicide pact with his mistress. So he's dead, his only son. So then the successor is going to be Franz Ferdinand. He and his wife Sophie are murdered by
like a wrong turning.
Gavrilo Princip, because their car stalls at the wrong moment going after a wrong turning exactly in Sarajevo. So now the person who is going to succeed Franz Josef is a completely useless. I mean, I hate to say this because I know we've got Habsburgs coming on the program in the new
but
year.
But he's useless, as we said, in a saintly way, reminiscent of Henry
VI. Right, of Henry VI. So here's our parallel. So he is, he was previously the Archduke Karl, and he is basically the great nephew of Franz Josef I. So the, what would that make him? The nephew of Franz Ferdinand. And he is, what is he? He's 29 when he succeeds. He's never really done anything very much. He hasn't even been, because no one expected him to succeed. He's just a sort of, you know, attendant Habsburg aristo.
Yeah.
So he succeeds to this empire that is in this colossal clash of kind of modern, you know, of sort of leviathans. And he doesn't really know what he's doing. So he's crowned in the Matthias Church in Buda in a ritual, Tom, that you will enjoy, that goes back to the year 1000.
Love that.
And the coronation of the first Hungarian king, Stephen I. I think they would call him István I. And he's crowned in this very...
He got sent a replica of the Holy Spear.
Well, this is what we're going to discuss, because Karl... So we're in 1916, in this world of kind of tanks, the Battle of the Somme, all this stuff. And he is crowned with a crown that is largely Byzantine.
Mm-hmm.
So this extraordinary thing, you can Google it if you haven't seen it, the Holy Crown of Hungary, which is much more than just a crown, because some people say it kind of is Hungary, that it is the symbol, it's the sort of legal personification of Hungary itself.
But Dominic, a while back we said we should try and get Otto the Great, friend of the show, into every episode, which we failed to do. But there is an opportunity here, because of course it's the Hungarians who get defeated by Otto the Great, and then they not only submit to German power, but also to the Christian faith and become devoted servants of the church.
And this is why, one of the reasons I think they've been given this crown, because the crown has been given there's some disagreement about exactly where they get the crown, but some people think the crown itself is given by the Byzantine Emperor Michael VII. Now, we will be referring to him in a later podcast in this 12 Days of Christmas. So it's amazing, the intricacy.
It all joins together, doesn't it?
Yeah, with which
it's a fabric. It's a choices. Tapestry.
Yeah.
Historical tapestry.
There are these fantastic enamels, beautiful sort of illustrations on the crown, which have been made in Constantinople. The crown is given to the Hungarians. It's all written in Greek and stuff. So it's still in Budapest today. You can still see it, I think, in Budapest today. And now the most famous thing about it is that the cross on the top is crooked. So if you look at it, it looks very peculiar, because the cross is all like the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And it has been, I think, since the 17th century when it was knocked, and they've never tried to mend it. So it's become a kind of tradition. But people think that there's all kinds of stuff with, is there a bit of the thorn, the crown of thorns from the crucifixion contained in the crown
somewhere?
I think
what we can safely say is it's very sacral.
It's very sacral. You're absolutely right. So Karl, who is this sort of slightly chinless nothing of a person, without being mean to him, he is crowned in Budapest with this. He's already been in Vienna now, because it's, of course, the dual monarchy of Austria-Hungary. So he's come to the Hungarian bit, he's crowned, there's a big banquet afterwards, but they cut that short. It's much, the celebrations are quite muted compared with normal, because of course they're in the First World War, and Austria is really struggling. You know, the country that started it all is doing very badly, but also of course it's got this huge multi-ethnic empire, people don't speak the same language, the army is
splitting apart,
it's all falling apart. So Karl is quite a decent sort of fellow. He is a very devout Catholic. He takes his responsibilities as emperor terribly seriously. And he has various ideas for how Austria can survive the First World War and go into the future. So he thinks, you know, we need to have a federal sort of state in Austria with all states, a bit like Franz Ferdinand had wanted to do before he was killed. He thinks the Croats should be given more of a say, so it should have a sort of South Slav element to it, so it's no longer just a dual monarchy. But all of this is just kind of fantastical, because it's quite obvious that the Austrians are not going to win and the empire's probably not going to survive.
And so he opens peace feelers, doesn't he?
He's always out opening peace feelers. Yeah, I think he basically spends most of his time sending messages via sort of intermediaries to the Allies, particularly to the Americans, after 1917 and sort of saying, yeah, can we do some kind of a deal? But by this point, he's such a junior partner to the Kaiser, to Hindenburg and Ludendorff, the military kind of dictators of Germany, that, you know, Austrians have so little freedom and maneuver, really. The Germans basically calling the shots on the battlefield, and it's irrelevant what he's doing. Interesting thing about him, Tom, do you know what his wife was called?
No.
Princess Zita of Bourbon Parma.
Great name.
She's
crazy name, crazy girl.
Well, do you know how many? She's one of how many daughters? How many sisters?
12.
17.
17.
17. Look at that. 17. Guess when she died?
1982. 1989. I'm not bad. I'm kind of the right ballpark.
You're in the right ballpark, but she was tremendously long lived. So she and Carl.
Where does she end up?
Well, they went to Madeira eventually, as you'll soon discover.
Yes.
But Carl was ineffective in the conference chamber, Tom, but very effective in the bedroom, because they had 8 children in 10 years.
Wow.
I mean, that's very Catholic behavior.
Yes, it is.
So anyway, poor old Carl, he's utterly swept away in November 1918. No one gives a damn what he thinks about anything. After his father, who had been such a great figurehead, I mean, this is a bit ominous, really, the comparison with our current queen for poor old Charles. Mm. I mean, Charles at least has been trained for, you know, was Carl hadn't been. So he's swept away in November 1918. The Austria-Hungarian Empire falls apart. All the constituent bits declare independence. And he basically is kind of kicked out. And he goes off to Switzerland. But what a lot of people don't know is that he never properly abdicated. So he sort of thinks, well, I'm kind of still the emperor.
So I can still try and come back.
Right. And in the chaos after the First World War, so in 1921, he basically decides the future is Hungarian. I will come back to Hungary. So on Easter Saturday, 1921, he just suddenly pitches up back in Hungary.
And is he greeted with open arms?
He's not. I'd like to take over now. Now, the fellow who's running Hungary is a man called Admiral Horthy, who's a former naval commander in the...
Well, the clue's Australia. In the name.
Well, it is in there. But a lot of people wouldn't know that Austria-Hungary had a navy, Tom. Based out of Trieste and all that sort of area. Well, Admiral Horthy, he's technically the regent. So you would expect he'd be delighted.
What the king says.
Yeah, but no.
Well, it's like Richard of York.
He says this is a terrible idea.
It's astonishing parallels.
The allies will invade again, which they will, because Romania, Czechoslovakia, Hungary's neighbours have basically said, if the Habsburgs ever come back, we will attack you. We hate the Habsburgs. We hate you. We will attack you if the Habsburgs come back.
I hope Eduard Habsburg isn't listening to this.
So poor old Carl, he's very disappointed. There's some strange business. He's come with no coat. I think because he was expecting to be installed kind of straight away in the warmth. Yeah. Of the Hungarian people's hearts. So he catches a dreadful cold. Anyway, he has to go back to Switzerland. But undeterred, Tom.
He has another crack.
He waits a few months till the autumn, and then he flies back in. This time he's a bit more prepared and he has armoured trains. And the armoured trains kind of shoot along. And
where did he get the armoured train from?
I think he just arrived at a station. And some people commandeer trains or something. I, to be honest, I haven't looked into the details of this.
It's a great adventure story.
Second coup, as much as I should have done. But then he's foolish. Instead of going straight to the capital and like killing all his enemies, he's not a violent man, so he proceeds slowly, stopping at every kind of village and hamlet to receive the acclamation of the peasants.
Yeah.
The peasants wave and they kiss his hand and give him flowers and stuff. So he's too slow. So basically they arrive and the Hungarian government again, Hungary's neighbours basically say, if you install him, we will attack you and kill you all. So the Hungarian government raises troops, sees off his small ragtag army, and they kick him out. And off he goes to Madeira, where he dies of a broken heart a year later.
Oh.
Very sad.
Age
Very
34,
sad story.
I gather.
Very young man. But 34 with how many kids? 8 kids. He's had 8 kids in 10 years. I mean, imagine being 34 and having 8 children.
Yeah.
God almighty, I can't cope with one. Well, anyway.
But you've got staff, haven't you?
Well, he's got staff. I don't have staff. Yeah.
No, I'm not saying you, but you haven't. You've only had one.
No, exactly. So anyway, so that's the end of him. But everybody says he's the most tremendous chap. And he's on his way to sainthood, I believe.
He's a venerable.
Yeah.
I looked him up. So he's like Bede.
Do you think he's...
Well, I'm not going to lie.
Bede never launched a coup.
If I was Bede,
yeah,
I'd be cross at that.
You'd feel devalued. You know, you're like one of these people who...
Bede, one of the great scholars of the church, yeah, you know, spent his life as a monk shivering up in Jonathan Wilson land.
He never led a country into world war, though.
No. And this guy, I mean, he's having children left, right and centre, launching coups.
Yeah, but uselessly. I don't think uselessly, to be fair. So the question therefore comes, Tom, who is better, Richard of York or Karl I of Austria?
Well, I think Karl because he didn't launch a civil war.
And because he did actually get his hands on the crown. I mean, he wore his crown with a crooked crown, not a paper
crown. Whereas Richard of York never became king and caused the civil war. So I think he was a bit of a nightmare.
Okay, so for once, this is probably the only podcast in which the Emperor Karl of Austria-Hungary has emerged as a victor.
Yeah, I'm glad for him. I'm happy for the lad.
So, 100 years after his failure to secure the crown of Hungary in a coup.
He secures the crown of the rest is history, listeners' hearts.
The king of hearts.
The king of people's hearts.
You know who we're doing tomorrow? Emperor Bokassa the First. I love emperors. I'm all about emperors on this podcast. Yeah, the Emperor Bokassa of the Central African Empire. It's laugh a minute with us.
He was a naughty boy.
He was a bad boy.
He was a very bad boy.
More on him tomorrow.
We'll see you there. And just to compliment him, we've got the coronavirus.
Oh, what a festive celebration!
No, ho ho ho.
We'll see you tomorrow. Bye.